Welcome to Season 2, Episode 16 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we have an interview with Jess Hartley. We have a review of Shadow Sword and Spell. And finally, we talk about Game Master Screams. Use them or not. Again, welcome to Season 2, Episode 16 of RPG Circus. My name is Jeff, and joining me as normal is Zach and Mark. It's, it's been a couple of weeks, and what a couple of weeks it's been.
Yep.
You know, just one of those things. I don't know how to describe it. I've just been slammed at work and everything. It's just like, wow, I don't know what's going on.
Boy, I hear you.
So,
well, it's getting towards the end of the fiscal year, I think. I think probably a lot of our listeners are in the same boat as far as just feeling that push for budgetary stuff and making sure everything gets in time. And so, but that's work stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, work stuff is fun. They're trying to have the IT department take over my project. That's a lot of fun.
Nice.
Yeah, it was bound to happen. But that's just the way it goes. Why don't we, let's do the news. We don't have that many news items, so let's just get them out of the way, shall we?
Let's do it.
Well, like I said, there's just not a lot of news this week. The big ones, I think, were, Frog God Games is officially the new publisher of Swords and Wizardry, which is kind of interesting. There was a little, I would say, a PR snafu at the beginning, would you say? I think they were trying to get across that they wanted to bump up the quality of the publication. But it came off a little, as my wife likes to call it, snarky.
Snarky's good. Snarky's good. But they were, you know, they came out right away and, you know, they were pretty upfront with it and apologized and said, look, you know, we've all written stuff that.
Oh, I agree. So.
And I was as irritated as anyone with it. And, you know, saying that, you know, it came off like they were slagging on amateur efforts that you can find on Lulu.com and whatnot, just for the listeners out there. But, you know, the more you with actually talking with them, it turned out to be pretty all right with it. So,
yeah, that was a really good interview that you did with them.
Oh, yeah. They were nice enough after I posted with all my, you know, butt hurt and all that stuff about, you know, because I kind of felt slighted as being one of those people who have their crappy amateur product on Lulu. but they were really nice and gracious and gave an interview where they kind of explained themselves and, you know, the perceived insult pretty much was bad copy is what it comes down to. And so,
well, I think you both said we've all kind of written stuff and I'm like, what the hell did I just write? I have no idea. You know, or you write something and you think it's funny and you're trying to be funny and everyone else takes it way too seriously. Those are usually the events. And I kind of think that that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to be a little humorous about things, but it just kind of rubbed everyone the wrong way. So,
And apparently there were some companies who they felt were kind of fly by night who were producing some Pathfinder stuff that wasn't quite up to snuff. So I think that was another aspect of it, but I don't think they meant to slag on the fans. So
no, I don't think so either.
Yeah.
Or the tons of people who put a lot of effort into Swords and Wizardry at the get go. So,
true.
Speaking of publishers, Nevermet Press is now the official publisher of the Open Game Table Anthologies.
Yeah.
This really shouldn't surprise anyone. Jonathan Jacobs has been doing this for a while. However, there was some as he describes it in his post about it, I guess there were some possible legal entanglement issues about actually having Never Met Press actually do it. I'm not quite sure why, but, you know, hey, I either that or he just felt it wasn't quite right to do that. But, however, apparently he is now technically the only operator of Never Met Press. The other two gentlemen that originally started with him have now both bowed out. So it leaves him as the only current member of that organization. So he can pretty much do whatever he wants with it now, which is good. I mean, that's, you know, I think for him it saves him from actually doing two different publication options, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's,
sure.
Because he, you know, doing one thing under the Core Mechanic and then the other one under Never Met Press. Now he can just do everything under Never Met Press. So
yeah.
I think that solves a lot of things. Our buddies over at Crafty Games have decided to release their Fantasy Craft Adventure Time of High Adventure via PDF through DriveThruRPG before you can actually buy it as a print copy.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool from what I've seen.
Yeah,
so yes, it does.
So that's kind of interesting. I was kind of... you know, we've talked about this before that, you know, that may be the new model at some point where, you know, everything's published electronically first, and if it does okay, yeah, it might get to see the light of day as print.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see several different models, and I think that's probably going to be one of them, definitely.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what, you know, what the market will bear in that regard. But I think for a lot of us, you know, for certain products, we already buy them electronically. We don't even... Mm-hmm. Print product, you know, for a, let's face it, for a 20-page, or let's just say a 34-page supplement or adventure, I think none of us have a problem just printing it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not, you know, a 100-page book, I think we'd want, you know, 200-page book, the DMG or something, yeah, we'd probably want that as a print, although most of us would like the electronic copy as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, Time of High Adventure, that's... I think I read, 96 pages?
Yeah.
And it's three adventures for Fantasy Craft, so, you know, maybe you can just print out the one you need or something. I guess it makes sense from that aspect.
Well, I'm just saying, that's 32 pages each. Or, you know, sure. if you have my Kindle DX, you can actually just use your Kindle DX to read the PDF and page through them as you need it.
Yeah.
I wish I had your Kindle DX. Yeah.
I would love a Kindle.
It's a bit pricey. I don't know how those PDFs would actually look on like my wife's Kindle, which is a smaller one. But you know, because
probably the one I would end up picking up anyway.
Yeah, well, you know, they're cheaper now. So,
yeah.
I mean, not.
They'll keep coming down.
The big expense is the e-ink display. Mm-hmm. That's what's killing everybody. So, and then of course, you know, there's people that say, "Well, it's not in color. It's not an iPad. I don't want it." And I'm like, "Okay, whatever." I want it to read books. I don't want it to surf the internet. There you go.
Yeah.
That's my viewpoint on it. And lastly, we have Joe Wetzel of Inkwell Ideas actually is doing his start of the open beta for Dungeonographer.
Oh, yes.
Which is... It's kind of anticipated by those who've used Hexographer for a while. I hope I pronounced that right. Is that how you would say
Hexographer?
Yeah. No, Dungeonographer.
That's how he pronounced it at Gen Con when I was talking to him.
Yeah, I couldn't remember. I know we both went to his little seminar, which I really wish more people had gone to. And if he does it again some other time, I would recommend, you know, hey, he's a pretty cool guy. He has a pretty cool little product, and he spends a lot of time on it, I actually think, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a labor of love for him.
This Dungeonographer looks awesome.
Some of the ideas he has, I think, is very, very impressive. So, other than that, I think that's pretty much the news for now, unless someone else has something else going on that they want.
No, I think that's it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Why don't we get to it? It is our great pleasure here at RPG Circus to introduce Jess Hartley, who has been kind enough to come join us on the show. Ironically, Jess is actually currently, I don't know what, few hours south of me. Is that about right?
Yeah, about 3.5 or so.
Yeah, that's
as the vulture flies.
Vulture, right?
Well, it's the desert, so there's not a lot of. I guess there are some Chiricahuan ravens and stuff out here, but it's kind of up in the northwest where I'm from originally. You know, if you went 3.5 hours, you'd be going through tons of towns and cities. And here there's like Tucson between you and me, and that's about it.
How did you guys get all these gamers out in the desert? I don't understand that, Jeff. You've got like this colony out there of awesome gamers.
He clones them.
No.
There's not really much to do out there, is there?
You know,
D&D was invented. I mean, it's Lake Geneva.
It's kind of weird, but Phoenix is kind of, you know, has gamers, don't get me wrong. But from what I've kind of gathered, the Tucson area has a lot more gamers than Phoenix, and it's a much smaller town, really. And I've yet to figure out why. I don't know if it's because of, U of A down there versus ASU up here or something. I have no idea. There's like this mental block.
I think it's partially, I mean, I think a lot of people game that aren't necessarily, it's not until people start building an actual community of gamers that you start to be able to tell how many there are. And Tucson has had Saga with Bo Radovich and the folks down there who've really worked in the last, well, at least since I've been in this area, last 3 years, really, really actively to really bring people together and do big open RPG gaming and events and like the Game Master Conference and things like that. So I don't know number wise how many there are comparatively, but there's like a more visual community because of that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Phoenix is kind of, I know all the Phoenicians are going to hate me for saying this, but we tend not be big volunteer or joiners up here. It's kind of like, oh, I have to travel down the road 30 minutes? No. And you're just like, what? You travel further than that to go to work, pal.
Yeah, I think that sometimes happens in major metropolitan areas, because I know that to some extent Seattle is kind of like that too. But Portland, where I spent time, you know, it's a smaller town. And, you know, I mean, it's still a big town for Oregon, but it's a smaller town, and you get more like willingness to travel and things like that.
Well, I remember when I was in Portland many years ago, when the internet really didn't really exist, it was all bulletin boards. I remember specifically a lot of the bulletin board systems there were interconnected, and they had a very vibrant RPG channel for message forms.
I believe that totally. I played, after I got started playing RPGs with D&D and Palladium and GURPS and that kind of thing, when I switched over to White Wolf type stuff for the first, 4 or 5 years I played almost exclusively online through, you know, Mushus and you know, IRC chats and things like that.
Wow.
Well, now, Mark, since I've hijacked your interview, I think you can start.
That's right. So Jess, what are your credentials in the RPG industry?
I invented RPGs. No, I'm just kidding.
Thank you.
I couldn't claim to invent the internet because somebody already got that one. But I started writing in the RPG industry. Actually, got started writing tie-in novels, media tie-in novels for White Wolf, and from there switched over to working on game supplements and eventually helping with game development. Predominantly in the New World of Darkness, I've worked on at least one project for all of the game lines that White Wolf's come out with in the New World of Darkness. And also Scion, the later two books, Demigod and God, which I guess aren't the last two books because they had some more come out after that. But and Exalted and... Gosh, dabbled on a little bit of everything for White Wolf. And then I've also done editing and fiction writing predominantly for other game companies. I worked on an anthology for 12 to Midnight, their Buried Tales of Pine Box, Texas, that was nominated for an Annie this year. And I'm right now a project that I'm working on for Mindstorm Labs for their Alpha Omega game is being released on a kind of a month by month basis. It's a novel really that's being released chapter by chapter, with each chapter kind of being its own short story, but they all tie up to make a novel length piece.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
It was kind of a fun way to look at it, because instead of just being able to look at, you know, like the overarching novel plot, each little story had to kind of have their own, its own, you know, climax and resolution and that kind of thing to make it interesting enough to read, even if the next one wasn't going to come out for a month or more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems like you wear a lot of hats, definitely in the hobby, Jess. What, aside from, you know, just actual gamer, what is probably your favorite out of all those that you mentioned?
Oh gosh, it just depends upon the time and the day. I love wearing so many hats because it means that I usually have a project of some sort that suits the mood that I'm in. You know, because it takes an entirely different kind of mindset to be working on, say, editing someone else's work, as I'm sure some of you guys know, versus coming up with original fiction or coming up with a game supplement or that kind of thing. One of my favorite parts, really, I mean, it's because it's getting to be a professional geek, is going to conventions and, you know, running panels or question and answer sessions, playing in games with people, and really getting a chance to talk to non-industry people about what they think about games and, you know, what they're enjoying and what's really doing it for them at any given time. Because it's really easy to get kind of a biased viewpoint when you're interacting with so much with industry folks. We kind of forget, you know, that we all started out as, well, most of us anyway, started out as, you know, gamers first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we can kind of semi-relate to that. We actually all were on Zach's GM's Jam panel at Gen Con this year, and that was a very fun event. We actually did much better this year than actually in 2009, although that room was still packed. So it was it's just like kind of a weird like group chat really, and there was just a lot of fun, because I mean I think we have the same problems as bloggers. We get kind of hyper focused and we sometimes lose focus about what other people actually are thinking about and talking about.
Yes. It surprises you when you've got people, well, for example, you know, Zach, you know, you were, you know, have been an Ennis judge several times in the past, and you know, it becomes like something like that comes up and it becomes this big focus for us. And we're like, you know, hey, my product was nominated, or hey, I'm judging the Ennies. And then we realize that even within the gaming industry, so many people have no idea what we're talking about. You know,
yeah.
I can love a product like a Fiasco. It just came out this year and was just like, whoa, earth shaking. Really, really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's so many gamers out there who have never played anything but, you know, D&D, or never played anything but World of Darkness, or, you know, have never played anything but Magic the Gathering. And so it's really easy to get to lose the big picture and think that everybody, you know, has this a similar experience and viewpoint to what we have.
Yeah, I think in the age definitely of micro celebrity like we have now, and we forget what a fractured hobby it is sometimes. I'm not saying fractured necessarily in a bad way, but just that's the way it is. You have countless tribes within the hobby that, you know, as well as you can do in something, you can, there's, you know, 80% of these people who have no idea about it. You might have 20% fanatics, but with that, you know, with everything that you do and all these, I guess, pursuits within the hobby and industry, do you ever kind of lose the picture? Is that ever a problem as far as, you know, this used to be about the gaming, or boy, there was gaming in here at some point, or do you continually come back to that?
It's been less my professional experience and more my, in the last 5 years, we've moved cross country. Well, this will be our third time.
Oh,
and we've gotten wow. progressively more and more remote. We were living in the Portland, Vancouver area in Oregon, which has for LARP, which I'm an avid LARPer. I'm not ashamed to admit it. Has a very, very avid LARP community in the Portland, Vancouver area, like multiple groups. And then we moved to an area in Western Massachusetts that was about 2 hours away from the nearest LARP in any direction. There was like one to the north, one to the east, one to the west, all about 2 hours. And then we moved here to Bisbee, and I can see Mexico from my backyard, but Tucson is the closest gaming community. And I mean, there's some in Sierra Vista, but it's a little military town, and you know, that's awesome. But it's people come and go, and I think that colors how the community builds, because it's a small town, and because you've always got people coming in and out as they get stationed, you know, in there and brought in for a while. So I'm very much looking forward to getting back to the Northwest and back to the I-5 corridor where, you know, there's so many gamers and so much going on. I'm really looking forward to being able to be more active in the actual gaming, you know, the recreational aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. I've found up here in the north of Chicago area that there is almost no community whatsoever. I've been having a really hard time since I moved trying to actually get into a group because they just don't really exist. So it's been a struggle.
I think that can be really challenging, especially it's one of the things I do like about LARP is that there are several LARP groups that are national or international. And so if you move from one state to another, one city to another, there's a chance that there may be another branch of that group, you know, local to you or, you know, 2 hours away. Mm-hmm. But it can be really hard with tabletop because it's such an intimate social situation. People are more willing to accept a newcomer to a 40-person LARP than they are to a mm-hmm. 5-person tabletop game. You know, you kind of have to become friends first and then work your way into the gaming groups with tabletop a lot of times.
Yeah. Now, you didn't go to Gen Con this year, right?
I didn't. I was very sad.
Yeah. Did you, I'm sure you heard about what White Wolf was up to with their booth.
What part? White Wolf's usually up to something, so...
Their booth that really wasn't doing anything? They just had the sort of bar set up?
Well, I think that the booth was doing one of the things that White Wolf does very good, which is catering to its clientele, to its customer base, and making them feel like they're part of something very cool and very, very, you know, kind of non-mainstream you know, working at a call center kind of thing. And White Wolf has always been really, really good at that, at catering to people, you know, catering to their gamers and making them feel like they can step out of their mundane lives and, you know, be a part of something really cool and awesome, like the Succubus Clubs and the parties that they always have at Gen Con and that sort of thing. So I think this was just kind of taking that to the nth degree.
Now, do you know if that was in any way tied into their big grand masquerade that they've got coming up next year, is it?
No, it's later this year. In New Orleans, yeah. I don't actually know. I'm not in Atlanta, and I'm not really privy to, you know, kind of the marketing plans and that sort of thing. But I wouldn't be surprised at all to find that Shane DeFries, who's one of the movers and shakers who's planning the Grand Masquerade, was also one of the movers and shakers at the with the booth, because it seems very much like his style. He throws a great party.
Are you planning on going to the Grand Masquerade?
Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to. Like I said, we're getting ready to move to Oregon, and between packing and trying to sell our house and that sort of thing, I'm just afraid that the time and the funds, neither one is going to be there. And I'm heartbroken because it's really supposed to be something awesome. I love the idea of the inclusivity that they're bringing in, not only the Camarilla fan club that, you know, has been their official fan club for years and years, but also mm-hmm. the One World by Night folks and other, you know, other active societies that have been running World of Darkness games for quite a while, and as well as independent RPG folks that are interested in the World of Darkness. I think they're really putting all out to make this, you know, the creme de la creme of the White Wolf gaming / party event. And mm-hmm. if anyone can make that happen, White Wolf will be able to do it. I'm very sad to be missing it.
Yeah. Now I'm
how
not
about you guys? Are any of you going?
No, I don't think any of us. I don't think any of us are LARPers, right?
Not really. And honestly, even if I was, unfortunately, my finances just wouldn't allow that.
Yeah, it's sad. I understand completely.
Now I'm not a LARPer myself, but you do hear a lot of stereotypes about LARP, uh-huh. about LARPers and everything. Mm-hmm. Why do you think those exist, and how do you think that those can be overcome by LARPers to sort of get them more accepted in the
hobby at large? Hello?
Did we lose him?
Over. Have I lost everybody?
I'm here.
Yeah, you're just having a little fun. Funkiness.
Am I cracking up again?
No, you're fine. Are you cracking up? You're always cracking up, but...
Okay. Are we good?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. This is actually one of the things that I addressed in One Geek to Another, which is my geek etiquette blog recently. Mm-hmm. I think that it's human nature to want to differentiate between us and them, and to make us whatever that us is, whether that's gamers and non-gamers, whether that's LARPers and tabletop folks, whether that's, you know, people that play video games versus people that play tabletop games, or people that play RPGs versus card games. I think it's really natural to want to differentiate there, and to also make ourselves feel better by making someone else less cool than we are. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I think that, you know, not every gaming style is going to be for everybody. Of course, some folks really like LARP. Some folks don't. But I don't think that you can really. I don't think that there's anything that anyone outside of each individual person can do to stop the stereotypes or the negativity. I think that's got to be something that each person just has to get to the point where they're mature enough to not put down other people for liking something that they don't like. It's kind of ridiculous. It's like saying, well, I like chocolate, so, you know, you're a weirdo because you like strawberry or that sort of thing. It's, you know, it's all a hobby. And mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't, unless someone is being personally insulting to me or publicly insulting, I tend to call people on it. I mean, if somebody's like, oh, well, LARPing's really, you know, I don't know. What, I don't know. People tend to not even say it to me, so I don't even know what they really say. But you know, if I tend to just, you know, ask, well, you know, have you ever tried it? It's not for everybody, but, you know, why do you think that it's, you know, that it means anything other than I like a slightly different style of gaming than you do? You know, mm-hmm. I don't know. You can't stop people from being judgmental and you know, immature in making judgment calls about other people's fun. But
yeah,
I think, you know, you just have fun in whatever way you do, and, you know, call people on it if they're being rude. I have a tendency to do that in general, whether it's about that or something else. I use furries as the example. They seem to be the current red-haired stepchild of the geek community. And you know, a lot of people who harsh out furries actually don't have any idea, you know, anything about it other than what they maybe saw on an episode of CSI or something. And so, you know, I just tend to call people with facts and say, well, you know, did you know this? Did you know that? Why are you saying this? You know, no, that's not true. No, you don't have to like this or that or the other thing, whether it's SCA or LARP or furries or, you know, whatever. But, you know, I tend to just, you know, expect people to be polite to you know, at least in public to one another and call them mm-hmm. if they're not. And yeah, I don't know. It's, I think it's, you know, it's like saying, why does sexism exist in our society? It does, you know, we do what we can to deal with it. And then, you know, we go on and ultimately, hopefully we all just go back to having fun.
All right.
Very good.
All right. Well, I think we're going to sort of call the end of this segment here because, well, we try to get in two or three things at every show, and I think it's time to move on to Zach's review of Rogue Games' latest creation, Shadow Sword and Spell, which he actually ran for a small group of... Well, actually, it wasn't that small, was it?
No, it was, what, seven people, I think?
Seven, something like that, people at Gen Con.
It was a big group. So, yeah, I think it was seven. So, yes, this is me. Hi. Rogue Games. You may know them from such products as Colonial Gothic, which is a very cool sort of paranormal horror investigation game set during the American Revolution. They also have Thousand Suns, which is sort of a homage to classic sci-fi and space adventure. And
yeah, I think they called it Imperial Science Fiction. Is there a term
basically
for it?
EC Tub, H. Beam Piper, some of Larry Niven stuff. That's the sort of vein. But today I'm talking about their newest product, which is Shadow Sword and Spell, or SS and S. It's definitely designed towards a kind of pulp human-centric fantasy. If you're trying to think of novels that might link into it, I would think of L. Sprague de Camp, Fritz Lieber, of course Robert E. Howard, many of the classic pulp fantasy, I guess you'd say, authors is what Rogue Games has gone for here. The product itself is 142 pages. You can get the print and PDF together for $12.99. It's digest size, so it's definitely a good little value. At least I feel it is. And it uses their 12 degrees system. For those of you who are not familiar with the 12 degrees system, it basically you roll 2d12, you try and roll under a target number, and you roll, you know, you add in your relevant stat plus your skill plus or minus any modifiers. If my target number was 12 and I roll a 10, well, that's 2 degrees of success. That tells me relatively how much I succeeded. You know, basically 5 degrees of success is better than 1 degree of success. And that also comes into play in combat, which I'll talk about in just a minute. So hence the 12 degrees portion. You can kind of see how they get to that. So, it's a pretty simple, straightforward system. You're not going to find a whole lot of complexity here, but it's not needed. It's pretty intuitive. Jeff, you were in my game. Would you say that you picked it up pretty quickly?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it wasn't that difficult, I don't think.
I don't think so. But it does have the stats you'd come to expect: brawn, quickness, toughness, wits, will. It's pretty self-explanatory. Those both work for your roll under that you have to do, sometimes like as a saving throw. And it's also the basis for the cost of your skills and part of your target number determinations. One thing to mention with this is that this is human-centric, as I said. This is not the game when you want to play 15 different kinds of elves or a shield dwarf, a gully dwarf, and a, I don't know, help me out here, aquatic dwarf. So, You know, basically. You know,
I don't know if they have an aquatic dwarf, but
they just sink, don't they? I mean, they're kind of bottom fillers.
They just walk along the bottom. That's like a really lobsters. Boring question. But I do think for a while now, and you know, I think we all get in moods or funks as gamers, but I have just been damnably sick of so many kinds of elves in my game that my eyes are about to bleed. And I kind of wanted something a little more simple, you know, something I've been rereading Elsbrig de Camp and some of the classic authors. And this game just really fits into there. You also have, it's a pretty bloody game. It's definitely for, how do I put this? It's not a game where you're going to take a battle axe in the stomach and laugh it off. You know, it does not only, it has kind of a spiral on your damage. For every 15 points of damage or vitality that you take, you're at -1 to all tests, -1 again at another 15 points. So, you know, you do weaken as you take more damage, sort of a damage track system. There's also a sanity rating because, you know, there are horrors unseen and horrors best, you know, things.
Yeah, I think that's something you forgot to mention, is they kind of have some of H.P. Lovecraftian influence.
They do. So. They do. Very, very true. Very true. So, you know, it is sword and sorcery, but there's plenty of eldritch horrors and, you know, things from beyond to be fought. And so you do sort of have a pretty basic system here, but it's a nice framework because we also, they talk about hooks. Hooks kind of remind me of, sorry, I'm drawing a blank, Aspects and Fate, to make a comparison. They're kind of your role-playing tools. They describe something about your character's history or story. And that might be, you know, if you want to play a certain Sumerian from the movie, you know, you might be a slave at the wheel for the better part of your adolescence, or you might be the exiled heir of a kingdom. You know, that's well and good. You can write these things down on your character sheet, but when you start bringing these hooks into play, you start with 5 of them. You can be rewarded with action points, which can be used for rerolls, easing the difficulty of target numbers. There's also the option for narrative control if you like to roll like that. But you can start to basically bring these hooks into play, which sort of helps tie the whole, you know, tie your background into the game and give you an incentive.
And
so that's something we've been seeing in a lot of games lately, it seems like. I think it's a nice idea.
And it's not only a player's tool, it's a game master's tool.
Oh, certainly, certainly. You know, it's helpful for you because rather than have 2 pages of backstory that your players later accuse you of not reading or something, you know, you've got these 5 short, sweet hooks that are digestible.
Well, not only that, it's there are going to be stuff that the players want to possibly have the game master activate, but for him from his side, because they get a bonus to that. So
very true. Very,
you know, because I've seen systems where they have all these adventure hooks, but as a player, you don't have any real investment to actually do something useful with them, or you don't. It's that you want to make. I've seen situations where players want to make them something that the game master isn't interested in actually messing around with, or something, you know. And it's like, because there's no benefit for him, so
yeah,
it doesn't advance the story. It doesn't help. It doesn't help the game master get a grasp on what is your character about. So.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, Zach, can you say a little bit about the background aspect? That sounded really interesting.
Well, sure. The backgrounds aspect is pretty cool because it's sort of a mix and match system, if you will. The mix and match system is sort of, you pick a civilization or a level of civilization. It can be primitive, barbarian, advanced, that sort of thing, or civilized. And that gives you, you know, certain starting skills, a certain background. Well, you know, that's well and good. But then you change that with a modifier. So I'm not just civilized, I'm decadent civilized. And so that might be different. And that immediately, you know, brings to my mind pictures of some ancient crumbling city where, you know, fat merchants sit and, you know, let the whole world go to hell. But then again, I might have, you know, I might be from a very pious society.
I don't know.
And I might be civilized pious, you know.
You know, Zach. So I hate to say it. Every time I hear the word decadent in society, the only thing I can think of is Futurama. I just always mentally just picture Hedonist Bot. I don't know why.
That may be a failing of the thing. I don't know that you can build Hedonist Bot in this. I think you could try it, but I'm
just... No, that would be a Thousand Suns things, but still.
Yeah, save it for Eclipse Phase, which is a great game that we don't talk enough about on here. So, I mean, there's a difference between a haughty barbarian and or a pious barbarian. And so it's kind of fun that you can really define your culture beyond, you know, okay, well, I wear furs and carry a club around, you know. Yeah, my people might be considered barbarians to most people, but we also revere our ancestors and are extremely religious, or we are extremely arrogant. You know, you might think us as just gathering rocks in the middle of nowhere, but to us, you're the barbarians. So
do each of those things then have mechanical aspects to them that come into play in the game?
They do. Basically, in the aspect of bonuses to the various skills and whatnot, making things cheaper. But that's sort of just a leader. And to me, it's more of another descriptor. Shadow Sword and Spell takes a lot of ideas that I don't want to call straight indie, but definitely more things we've been seeing cropping up in game design more recently. And they kind of dilute it to a system where someone who maybe even doesn't normally like that sort of thing just sees it as another way to describe their character. None of these things are going to take a lot mechanically to describe, and they're going to give you a little kicker to do it, you know. You know, that +2 to diplomacy or whatever. But it is a way to sort of, along with your backgrounds, get fleshing out of your character during actual character generation. There's none of that, okay, I make the character. So to me, when I'm rolling up some NPCs for the game that I'm planning on, I'm sort of getting an idea for this guy as I go along, which is kind of fun. I enjoy systems where you do that, where they start to take shape, not just from their stats, but from some of the decisions you're making about them during the course of character generation. So,
that's cool.
Yeah. Real quick, I know we're short on time, but I wanted to touch combat too, because I think everybody really enjoyed combat. The stats, they have sort of an interesting system for... This is where some of the 12 degrees comes in. Instead of saying your spear does 2d12 damage, the spear will have a rating like 4 and then parentheses 30. Basically, that means you have a damage multiplier of 4 and you have a cap on your damage of 30. Which means if I hit you and you don't dodge or whatever, the system does. It's not just passive combat, by the way. You can dodge and parry and that sort of thing, which then subtracts from your opponent's successes, which is kind of cool. Because it's like, oh, man, this guy just got 6 successes. He is probably going to kill me unless I do enough of my dodge to take away from it. It's not just sitting there waiting to be hit, which is
That's always cool.
But back to this, if I have a spear that has a damage multiplier of 4, that means if I have 5 degrees of success, I go 5 times 4 equals 20. That 30 is the damage cap. Basically, if I have, you know, something ridiculous like 10 successes, it's going to top off at 30. So there's definitely, because it's a damage multiplier, you can just do 4 points of damage around, or you might do 30. So it's a pretty big swing in combat, which does make a little more lethal. There's some options where you can make your armor ablative instead of being a threshold that they have to hit over, basically, which makes it a little more deadly. That's how we played at Gen Con. I'm sure everyone appreciated that. It is a very simple, again, everything Shadow Sword and Spell does is pretty simple, but at the same time, it's pretty satisfying, at least for me. I really like games that are light but still give you a lot to tinker with. And Shadow Sword and Spell also has a wiki that they've set up called The Tome just for that. And I've actually done a couple little things. I did an NPC and I did some rules for Legend. Say you want to, you know, be basically if you want to play, say, right after the Trojan War or something, or during the Trojan War, and you want to be a Greek hero using this system and you want to see what your Legend rating is, I've made some skills for that. It seems like a very easy game to write for, which is always nice. It's it's very appreciative. I'm very appreciative to have something out there that really just turns that light bulb on for you. And that might be the best compliment I can give for Shadow Sword and Spell, is that for $12.99, I've gotten an awful lot out of it for what I've purchased for it. So,
and my closing.
And that gets you both the it gets you both the PDF and the print version, right?
Yes, yes. We've talked about the Bits and Mortar initiative before, and Rogue Games is part of that. They're starting that up where here soon, if you are going to purchase this, if you want to support your local gaming store, you will be able to get the PDF as well for that. So, say I buy the print copy from my local gaming store, I'm also going to be able to get the PDF copy for that same price for free, basically.
That's awesome.
You can also do it for Rogue Games. I think the PDF alone is $6.99, but I'm like, man, the print and the PDF is only $6 more. So, the only drawbacks, I would say, to be fair, are there have been some typo issues, and there were some problems with people not understanding how the skills worked. It's pretty easy, and there's a lot of options. This is also Shadow Sword and Spell Basic. It is a complete game, but basically within the next few months, I believe, Rogue Games will be putting out a Shadow Sword and Spell Expert, which is sort of like the end game. Think of it as building your stronghold, governing nations, instead of the common spells, which are pretty low-level cantrips. This is not a game for people who like to be all-powerful magic users. The arcane spells will be an expert, and those not only cost you vitality, you know, basically hit, aka hit points, like the common spells do, but they also cost you some sanity because you are drawing on powers that you really have no business messing around with. So
that's awesome.
It very much gives a sword and sorcery sort of feel to it. So, you know, also there's a very light setting in there. There's some game master magic. There's a wonderful section on alchemy, which is an awful lot of fun, which kind of substitutes for some of the magic effects you'd normally get. So, small bestiary, and yes, there is an Appendix N, which is always better in my book. So, there's always a check mark in my book if you have that check plus. So,
yeah, and I'll say in closing this segment that I have to say that was probably the funnest con game I've played in a while.
Oh my gosh, it was so much fun to run. Our buddy Michael Wolf over at Stargazer's World, we had the Skelds, who were basically your generic Danish slash Viking sort of culture. And for some reason, they were fighting this tiger cult in the jungle, because it was a little-known fact that Denmark is just littered with ziggurats all over the place. But it worked in play. You know, it worked just fine. So Michael actually became king in the game. They were seeing who could get the most glory to become the heir, and it was very much a it was an awful lot of fun. It was I agree with you, Jeff.
So, well,
I might actually pick that up.
It definitely is a definitely pick up. So, and especially, of course, you know, the game systems, if you like that, then of course, you know, there's obviously, you know, Colonial Gothic and Thousand Suns, which use pretty much the same systems. There are some variations. I know that they've noticed that there are some issues between the rule sets.
Right.
You know, and that some of it just came down to interpretations of the writer who wrote that particular rule set compared to the source material. So, you know, but that, let's face it, all games have that.
Oh, sure.
So, anyway, I'd like to close off this our topical section with one of the ones that actually sort of, I believe, started the thought process in this one started because of some stuff that was said on Rogue Games about Game Master screens. And, you know, Game Master screens are one of those things that, have, I don't know, I think they've been around for as long as tabletop RPGs have existed. It's kind of one of those things. There are people that believe that, you know, Game Master screens are anachronistic for tabletop games. You know, they have no place on the modern RPG tabletop game. It's, you know, and I think that, you know, this kind of fuels the whole old school, new school, you know, verbal dueling that people tend to do about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really sure. It's kind of one of those things. As a longtime gamer, I'm almost 40, and I've been gaming since I was at least 10. So it's about 30 years, give or take. You know, I grew up using a Game Master screen, and, you know, I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, you know, Game Master screen is great because depending on your game system, as a Game Master, there may be things that you need to look up, and it's nice to have a ready reference right in front of you, you know, without having to flip through some book or flip through like three or four sheets of paper to find that one little weird modifier table. And on the other hand, you know, there is the school of thought that, you know, hey, you know, what's actually happened is the Game Master is just hiding die rolls, and, you know, and he might be cheating behind the screen. Kind of reminds me of the Wizard of Oz, you know. It's like, never mind the man behind the curtain, you know. And I think a lot of people think that the Game Master screen is this curtain that they should be able to look behind. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, my experience has just been that, you know, I prefer to do it because, well, you know, I do have material that the players don't need to see. Maybe I have a map, you know, or maybe I have some other notes. And, you know, depending on where I game, the quarters can be either very spacious or very cramped, and at least having that screen, even a small screen, to put that stuff aside is good. That's not saying that, you know, I absolutely need it, but I don't know. I think, you know, I don't know. I mean, what is your opinion? Do you think there is actually a need for that separation between Game Master and player like that? Or, I mean, what is your guys' experience been with that?
For me, I know that if I've got a Game Master screen up, I may be cheating, but my players should be grateful because I'm keeping them from getting killed. When I use the Game Master screen, if I fudge rolls, it's in the player's favor because I'm much more story-oriented in that I want to tell a good story, and having the entire party get wiped out by a pack of kobolds in the first adventure is not helpful to the story at all when you don't have anybody left to tell it. So that's usually what I use it for. I have discovered, though, when I do set the screen down, you can use it as a reference by just laying it out in front of you and using that as well, which I haven't seen too many people do, but I found to be pretty useful.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like it just because I like to have some separation from my notes and stuff. It's not that I'm sitting back there fudging dice rolls every time. It's that I have a lot of stuff that I don't want to, you know, I set up my minis back there. I set up the notes. I write notes to the other players. The place we play normally doesn't have enough separation where they're not going to see what I'm doing. It's not really because I want to say, look at me, I'm the GM. This is a symbol of my authority, you know, but at the same time, it's just very useful to me between the charts that I do use and having it back there. You know, to me, the players are just going to have to trust me. And I've never had a problem with that in my groups. Interestingly enough, a couple years ago at another GM seminar at Gen Con, we had a woman who was just dead set that she had to roll in the open. And she's like, I can't hide stuff from my players and they're metagaming and it's awful. I'm like, why don't you just use the screen? She's like, no, we have a contract. And, I mean, they had the whole social contract where they were not going to roll unless it was in the open. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, they need to – I'm not saying you can't roll in the open, but why don't you just have a GM screen? Well, that seems – you know, and she had – I mean, she was just – I was like, you know, just put up a book. It doesn't have to be a GM screen. Put up a folder. So I think a lot of people just see it as a remnant of the bad old days or something. But I don't see it like that.
I think that if you're concerned as a player, if you're concerned about the GM cheating to make you lose, you've got more things to be concerned about than, you know, the GM screen itself. It sounds like there's some inherent violations of, as this woman said, social contracts. I mean, if it's that antagonistic of a situation that you're worried that the GM is going to fudge roles to make, you know, to your detriment, not like you were saying, but, you know, to like they're going to roll for their NPCs in a way that is going to be detrimental to your fun and to your enjoyment of the game and that sort of thing. I don't know. I think that's much more indicative of an antagonistic situation between the GM and the players as, you know, individuals, as opposed to the antagonist situation between the NPCs and the PCs, you know, which is a good thing. But if your GM and your players have an antagonistic situation, that's not happy fun for me.
Yeah, usually if that's the situation, I my recommendation always been is like, you're obviously in the wrong game. Either the guy's the wrong game master, or you're not playing the right game, or you're just in the wrong group.
And, yeah, or if you're playing, I mean, if you go ahead.
You're playing with the Knights at the dinner table at that point.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've played in games casually, you know, not for very long, but I've played in games where I felt like either the GM was fudging the rules because they had something to prove to make sure that they, you know, they kept us in our place as players, or they fudged the rules to favor one of the players versus others. But regardless of, you know, what the exact situation is there, yeah, that's not the right group for me to be playing with.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, I guess that's it. I think the problem with Game Master screens for some people is just a perceptual issue. I think you hit it on the head there, Zach. They view it as, you know, this is a mark of, you know, the Gaxian tyrannical Game Master thing, and I will never have it, you know, which is like the same thing with rolling dice in the open. There are those people that say, you know, how can you know, it can't be a fun game unless everything is equal. And my answer to that is that, you know, I'm the game master, I'm the final arbitrator, things are never really fair.
if the game master wants to kill you, they're going to kill you.
You know, like,
whether they're rolling in the open or not, all they have to do is drop a dragon in front of a bunch of first level characters. So I don't really see a point to...
I'm just saying, you know, and at that point, if that was the case, then you're obviously... I'm in the wrong... You know, I shouldn't be a game master for one, and you're obviously in the wrong group.
Yeah.
So,
well, but you know, people play for different reasons. Some people play for that victory, whether it's a dungeon master or a player, and I usually don't stick around too long in those groups, kind of like Jess there, it sounds like, but... I mean, that's what some people are in it for, and I mean, that's fine. It's a big hobby, but I mean, I think that kind of lays into it, is that suspicion that you're trying to cheat me out of my hard won victory, or it's some detriment to me. So,
yeah, well, I'll tell you what, you know, our listeners, those of you that are out there, and we know you're out there because, well, I'd looked at my stats from last year, and we have a 472% jump on our Google Analytics from last year at this time. So,
excellent.
Yes, you guys are out there, and you guys are actually listening, and we want to thank you for that. If you have an opinion on this this fine topic, you know, go ahead and drop us a comment. And actually, speaking of comments, we actually have an audio comment. It's a little lengthy. It's about 4.5 minutes, 5 minutes. I think that the person deserves... their listen. They took the time to go ahead and call our toll-free comment line and drop us a comment. So let's see what they had to say.
Greetings, gentlemen. My name is John McDonald from Manchester, New Hampshire. I just wanted to say I've been listening to your podcast for a couple of months now. I've actually gone through and listened to the entire run, and I really enjoy it. It's actually inspired me, and I know you're going to love hearing this, to dust off some of my game stuff and try to get back in. Unfortunately, I work in retail, which means my hours are completely jumbled, so it's hard for me to get consistent time, but I'm going to make the attempt. I imagine you'll be happy to hear that you've inspired another gamer to get back in the game. I did have one comment from a previous podcast talking about spot versus search, and why would you have two different skills? And I actually, my own personal take on it is spot was always a passive thing to me. You know, it's visual acuity, your ability to pick something out from essentially a glance or look around your surroundings, where search is a more active skill, actually incorporating not just vision, but touch, smell, anything like that that would have you checking an area more thoroughly. Now, in my own personal instances, I've always used Spot as passive, passive that I do for the characters. They don't roll their Spot check. I do. That way I can slant it towards the character. You know, I might slip them a note saying, you noticed this. Now, depending on how the character is being played, what their background is, they may choose to point it out to the group. They may not. It just gives another opportunity for role-playing. Search, of course, I have them do the role because it's something they do actively. So a search might reveal something that a Spot wouldn't. Say, you know, you open a cabinet, there's an uneven patch that turns out to be a trigger for a trap door or a compartment, and they wouldn't have found that from a simple Spot. They would find it by opening the cabinet, feeling around in there, feeling something different. So that's my take on Spot versus search. This is my first call. Hopefully it won't be my last. I really enjoy your podcast. Give you a little bit of my background. I'm a longtime role player. I've been playing since the early 80s. Started with D&D. My favorite is Rolemaster. Yes, don't hate me. I love Rolemaster. Unfortunately, I find that you know, I've tried to play it with people who aren't interested in Rolemaster. It just doesn't work out, so I've stopped trying to force my game of choice on people. So, but I've played a lot of different games, and I like relating my experiences with them, so you'll probably hear from me in the future. So thanks again. Thank you for doing a great job, and I definitely look forward to your future podcasts. One last thing. I don't know if you're allowing this, so I'll put it at the end so that you can edit it out if you don't want to get involved with it. But I'm just saying that I just want to do a shout-out to our local game store. So anybody in southern New Hampshire, northern Massachusetts, check out Myriad Games in Manchester and Salem. They're great people. They have a lot of events, a wide variety of games. And like I said, they're just all-around great people. So give them a look. And they're online at myriadgames.com. So thanks again, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Well, I have to say thanks for that that comment. And yes, we do allow those because, well, you know, one of the most important things we can do in this hobby is support our local game stores because, well,
absolutely,
they survive on really thin margins. So,
I used to work at one, so
yeah. So anything we can do to support them, if you ever want to call us and give us a comment and just say, "Hey, I live in this area and we have this fantastic game store," I don't care. That's fine by me because, you know, we need to support those people because, in essence, they're not the conduit to the hobby that they used to be in the back in the 80s, but they're a vital component to this hobby because without them, you don't get to connect with other people as much, I don't think.
Yeah.
Even with the internet, I don't, going to the hobby store or game store and talking with somebody else is very important.
Very true. And Rolemaster, huh? Awesome.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
You're not alone out there, man. Hey, hang in there. Keep the faith. This has been a good show. You know, we got a Rolemaster fan out there, and Jess Hartley used to play Palladium. So,
hey.
Jess, what was your Palladium game of choice? I got to know. I wanted to ask
you. Oh, gosh. It has been years. And it's all kind of I hate to say it, but, you know, kind of beer tainted haze.
Oh, so Rift then. Yeah.
It would have to be if you were playing Palladium.
Yeah. Oh, man. Oh.
Yeah. Oh. I went there.
One day, I'm running Rifts for you guys. I don't know if we'll survive, but we're going to do it.
Everything's so better with the word plasma in it, right?
That's right. That's my rule.
I want to be a glitter boy.
Yep.
I think,
or a plasma rifle.
I think actually my favorite was back when Palladium was had the TMNT license. So we were playing old Yeah, that tells you how long ago it was, right? Was, after the bomb and that sort of thing.
Man, Eric Wujek did such a good job with that game, Ninja Turtles. I had so much fun creating different mutants and stuff. That was that's probably my that's probably my favorite Palladium product to this day.
See?
Yeah.
You know, cool. And that's and that's back when Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was not a completely its kids thing. You know, it wasn't like
stupid cartoon ruined
exactly. Anyway, I want to thank that gentleman for his comment again. And if you want to leave us a comment, you can either email us at info@rpgcircus.com or leave us a voicemail. And you can do that by calling us at 1-888-643-6322 or contact us on our Skype account at RPG Circus. And if you have any comments, you can go ahead and just leave us a message there. One final thing for our listeners. If you want to actually get some of these fine stickers that we happen to have that are 2.5 inch by 2.5 inch, you can send us an email with an address. And if you happen to live pretty much somewhere in North America, I'd be more than happy to send you a few. So there is that. We want to thank Jess Hartley for actually coming on the show. We had a few little connection issues before the show, but we got those sorted out. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me, gentlemen. It's been a blast.
All right. And I think that's all we have time for because we need to get – it's actually late, I think, on everybody's side. So we're going to go ahead and get out of here. So. Well, that last bit was supposed to be RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US 3 license. For more information, go to creativecommons.org.